going on? This is Toki and Noah, and you're listening to Chicago Bullseye.
Give it all you got, take your very best shot, and may the best team win. The time is now, the name of the game is action. They're on the floor, and they're ready to score, so let the game begin.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another exciting edition of the Chicago Bullseye. We have the great Keith Franz on. Keith, how you doing, brother?
Not too bad. Just waiting out this off season. Hopefully, it's closing in now.
50 days, I believe, from today before opening night. You know, a much shorter time for opening of training camp, and I can't get here soon enough. I know everybody's excited about the NFL, which I am too, to a lesser degree, but. It's in the window here. We're almost there, man. We're almost there. So, exciting times. You pretty excited?
Oh, I'm pumped. I'm going stir crazy. I just want to see, you know, the continuity between the starting lineup. Obviously, that's probably the biggest concern and the biggest thing that Fred has to figure out for the season. So, I'm excited to see how that happens. I think preseason should be exciting, too, since we got a couple mini position battles there.
Yeah. So, in the interim, since our last discussion, I was a guest on the Lockdown Bulls show. Really enjoyed my time with Jordan, Matt, and it was really excited to jump on and talk basketball with them. I know some people, I received a lot of emails, a lot of tweets about it, and some people were concerned that it got heated. I mean, come on. That's what I'm about, man. I love getting heated and passionate about talking about the beloved Bulls. So, believe me, that wasn't an issue, and I didn't think anybody crossed the line there. I mean, gosh, we've gotten probably more heated than I did on that show, I'd probably say, and with the Bamba talk. So, you know, definitely was not a problem there. But I did receive a ton of questions that I wanted to address regarding that show, additional questions around some of the topics we discussed. So I thought I'd bring Keith in also to provide his input. And why don't we hit the ground running with those?
Sounds like a plan. But no, heated debates, that's what sports debates are all about. Hell, any debate in general. It's not all about kumbaya.
Exactly. I agree with you 100%. So, number one question, I apologize, I'm not going to mention everybody's email or Twitter handle in this. This one is from Riv. Matt accused you of, not to be confused with the Riv man, who I often refer to on many of previous shows, who does quite a bit of stats for me, does a great job. Matt accused you of overestimating Bulls players. Could you address this point and admit you may be overrating some Bulls players? You know, I think specifically who am I overrating? It's definitely not. I don't think Zach LaVine. I'm definitely not overrating who else on the team. I could possibly be guilty of overrating. Well, the guys I could potentially be guilty of overrating are clearly Larry, who I think I've said in the past has top 10 ability and top 10 potential. So I call me guilty if you disagree with that statement. The other guy I think most people say I'm overrating is Jabari Parker. I think Jabari's going to be their lone all-star representative this year. That's how good of a year I think Jabari Parker is going to have. I spent a ton of time just going through the his game tape, and I've just been blown away with how good he's been and how poorly he was utilized by Milwaukee. And I think if the Bulls have any sense of intelligence, I believe they do, they're going to utilize him in a much different fashion and take advantage of what this kid has to offer. What say you?
I say it depends on what you're overrating. When you're talking about potential, you're not talking about guarantees. You're not talking about something that's set in stone. You're talking about what that player brings to the table in a singular situation. You never know how a player's skill sets and talents are going to work with the pieces around them when you're just bringing somebody in. So from what you're saying, Jabari Parker does have the skill sets. I do think he's an underrated passer. I've been critical of his assist numbers to his turnover numbers. I think a lot of that comes to opportunity. He does show the ability to be a very crafty playmaker from a wing spot. So I think he has plenty of room for improvement there, and he has the skills to do so. All-around offensive skill set, there's not much that the man can't do. So do I think you're getting a little ahead of yourself in saying that he's going to be the Bulls' lone all-star? A little bit. I think it's going to be an open competition, and I don't think we're going to have an all-star next year. But outside of that, I don't think you might have a little too much enthusiasm when speaking about a topic when it regards to players. The Lowry top 10 thing, I don't know. Lowry's got some crazy skill sets. He's showing how much of a freak athlete he is through the summer, putting on those pounds. So I don't think that a lot of the things that you say are out of the realm of possibility. I think you get a little overexcited, but I don't think you're too unrealistic by any means.
Yeah, big picture. I mean, this is, I know Matt accused me of overestimating the Bulls players. And in the context of our argument, I think he's overrating the rest of the league. I mean, that's what I'm going. I'll go back to is, you know, he was, Matt and Jordan both think it's insane that anybody would say the Bulls would have 40 wins. And my point is that I'm not. Yeah, sure, I may be overrating some of the Bulls players. I think he's overrating the Heat. I think he's overrating Charlotte, the Pistons. Those teams aren't very good, and those are the three teams I think that we're competing with for that seventh spot. The Heat, Charlotte, the Pistons, and the Bulls are in that group that I have at 7 and 8, fighting for number 7 and number 8. So maybe I'm guilty of that. Tell me who's better than Lauri Markkanen on the Heat's roster. Who's better than Jabari Parker, talent-wise? You know, I mean, Goran Dragic is on a second. That guy's a fading player. He's over 30. You know, James Johnson. I mean, there's tons of guys in that team that I don't think are really that great talent-wise. I know they might have a better coach, but, you know, in the long run, talent wins. I think the Bulls have a far more talented roster. And that's what I like to do. I like to match up. Look at the roster. So if you're going to say, who's better, the Bulls or the Heat, for example? Look at the Bulls roster. Look at the Heat roster. Give me your top 10 players. And I think in the vast majority of times, the Bulls will have 6 or 7 of the top 10 players.
Well, and my only argument to that would be when you look at the Bulls roster, a lot of what you're looking at is future potential. It's not going to be immediate potential for this upcoming season. Obviously, we have plenty of potential to break out. A lot of the rosters, like the Heat, they don't have the greatest players, but Goran Dragic is still an all-star caliber player. They do have a good coach. They have veterans who have been to the playoffs consistently and know how to win. But so that kind of stuff does matter.
Yeah, but what have they done in the playoffs? Nothing. You know, they have no success.
Well, nothing. They're in the same position we were. They're in mediocrity, you know, making it to the first round and getting kicked out every year, and they just don't want to hit the rebuild button. They just keep throwing money at it, and they're making the playoffs. So I guess they're content being where they are. So they do have the experience on us, and they do have proven all-stars, even if they are about to go over the hill.
Yeah, and I would counter, you know, Jabari Parker, who I think is the most talented player, arguably, on both rosters, has at least seen the second round. You know, who's really had second-round success on the Heat?
Yeah, that's not a good argument to make, Fred. Jabari's played 7 games in the playoffs and only averaged 10 points per game, so I wouldn't call him a playoff-experienced vet either.
You know, maybe guys can point
to
on the Heat.
The most experience on our team
at least
is Omir Asik.
To the second round. I mean, my bigger point is you could say the same thing about almost every player in the Heat. None of those guys have had any playoff success. You know, I mean,
Kelly Olynyk did pretty good with Boston.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm not saying Kelly Olynyk's a world beater. Long term, I think the Bulls definitely surpass the teams in that bottom tier that will be competing for the last spot or two in the playoffs. But this year, we really don't know what to expect. We added Jabari Parker, who we have to see if can stay healthy. I know his 2 injuries were freak anomalies. That is still a concern. And outside of Jabari, we added all rookies. Our whole rotation is practically under 25 years old. Mm-hmm. We only got one player in Robin Lopez who's 30 years old if Holiday's left out of the equation. And everybody's under 25.
Yeah, but LaVine, you know, LaVine has been in the league several years. You got Parker been in the league several years. It's not like they're all rookies. I completely concur with you that they're young. But, you know, Lopez is a valuable veteran who will be starting more than likely. You know, Holiday will probably be coming off the bench. I understand the point, big picture, but the young guys don't lack experience for the most part, you know, obviously outside of Wendell Carter Jr. Let's move on to the second question. If 6 teams are ahead of the Bulls, Fred, how do you get to 40 wins? I still don't understand your math. And let's start with the 6 teams. I mean, we haven't heard your comments on what I said. I think there's a clear tier 1 in the East. Just talking about the East right now. You know, you got the Raptors, I think, have the ability to be the best team in the East. I think Kawhi Leonard is a step up, obviously, under DeRozan, a significant step. If Kawhi, it all depends on, you know, who shows up. If it's Kawhi Leonard of, you know, a couple years ago, if that's the guy who shows up, they're the best team in the East. If not, well, then probably Boston, right? But you got the Raptors, Boston, and Philly. I have Philly third. That's tier one. Tier two, I have Milwaukee. I have Indiana, and I have the Wizards. And I will say that I think that they're significantly below the top tier. And I think every one of these teams in this tier is kind of precipitous. Could be on a precipitous drop if you have one injury to a key player. I mean, that's almost true with every team, but especially these teams. And you know, the Wizards, who the heck knows, man? That team is such a combustible potential mess. You know, obviously they enter Dwight Howard is a big addition, but it's Dwight Howard, right? I mean, he hasn't exactly
been Dwight Howard, and they had plenty of locker room issues last year without Dwight Howard, and Dwight Howard isn't bouncing around from every team because people like him.
Right. So I will admit, I mean, if they're healthy, I think those teams are better than the Bulls at 3-4, at 4-5, and 6. And then I have the Bulls at 7. Do you agree with the list of the teams I have ahead of them? And who else do you have ahead of the Bulls?
I agree with your first tier outright. I think that one's a no-brainer. The second tier, I do have Detroit included in that second tier. I think after adding the coach of the year in Dwayne Casey, having Blake Griffin for a full season, and getting Reggie Jackson back, I do expect them to be a playoff team. So I have them in that tier. And then in the tier below that, I have Miami, Cleveland, Chicago, fighting for that last playoff spot.
Sure. I mean,
not in any particular order, just in general.
Yeah, you gotta
I think
make a
the Bulls
assumption.
Will be in the mix for that last spot, though.
You got to make a big assumption that Blake's going to be healthy. The guy's never healthy. You know, so I mean, I agree. If he's 100%, he plays every game this year, Detroit could easily be better than the Bulls. I just
they got two all-star caliber players and the coach of the year, and Reggie Jackson. Although he's got his own problems, he isn't a bad player when he's healthy.
Yeah, I just don't. They were trying to make the playoffs last year when they got him, and they failed miserably. I just don't see them being. I think you could be right. They could be better than the Bulls. I think Bulls could easily be better than them. You know, I don't think it's like, I think it's probably a 50-50 with that team. I probably have Detroit as the 8th seed. But no doubt, those four teams that we mentioned, I think Charlotte, the Bulls, Miami, and Detroit are all pretty close. But I think that the Delta and the out of those four rosters, without a doubt, I take the Bulls going forward. I think most smart people would. You know, the question is this year, and I keep on making that 7-seed prediction. You know, we'll see. So who do you have falling out of the top six then? Is it the Wizards?
Either Wizards, yeah, probably, just because, like you said, they have a very volatile locker room. I know Gortat was part of the problem there with the locker room and the verbal war that was going on with John Wall while he was out on injury, and they're doing better because they pass more when John Wall's not there and whatnot. But I don't know if Dwight Howard's going to fix that problem. I think he might add to that problem. They might have to move on from Dwight just to get rid of him at some point in the season, for all we know.
So. Yeah, so back to the email. I mean, the gist of the email was, if six teams are ahead of the Bulls, how do you get to 40 wins? Well, that's just common sense. A 7th seed, more often than not in the past 5 years, has had between, you know, 41 and 47 wins. So if I'm saying the Bulls are the 7th best team, and I'm already admitting six teams are better, well, it's not that hard to get to 40 wins, guys.
No, I think their math's kind of confusing. It's very rare that a team will make the playoffs being under 500. So
yes, exactly.
You know, all the way to the A seed, you're expected to have at least 41 wins. So I don't know where your math is too far off there.
That's right. So I mean, the Bulls play 52 against the East. They got to go 32-20 against the East and go 10-20 against the West. I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that they can get to 40. That's my math on that. You know, if anybody thinks I'm wrong, that's fine. You know, but I don't think people are crazy for saying 40 plus wins. Like, I have them at 44. You know, so I know there's a lot of people, but I'm just saying, like, on the Locked On Bulls show. All right. I mean, the guy, the previous before I came on, that was my whole argument, is how the Bulls get to 40. It's not insane. It's to go 500 in the East means you're 27-27, right? Just to go 500 in the East. So that's what Vegas had him at, basically. I mean, all you got to do is go 500 in the East. I don't think that's difficult at all.
No, I mean, the East going, but then you also have to go 500 in the West, and that might be a lot harder. Last year, 11 of our 27 games did come against teams ahead of us in the lottery, so teams that were trying to lose. Nine games that we had against playoff competition that we won, four of them were resting their star. Their star was injured, so like the Boston game where Kyrie was sat, or the Philly game where they sat Embiid, and stuff like that. So we do have concerns. Our record last year is a bit misleading because of the way that the league was playing. Everybody was losing, but we also didn't have Zach LaVine at all.
But plus, we were trying to lose, though, right? I mean, obviously, you can point to some of those games. I could point to the – first of all, let me make a correction. Obviously, all we have to go – to go 500 in the East, you need to go 26-26. That's your 52 games. Correction there. So you got to win 26 games to go 500 in the East. Then that'll get you 26, period. Take a step back. I mean, we start out the season, we had Portis missing the first 8 games, and we had Dunn missing the first 4. How many teams start out the season with 3 rotation players? 3 rotation players out. It's pretty
well,
rare.
And then we lost Nwaba, who started getting into it too. So,
yeah.
No, we were definitely down, and it helped us. It was a blessing in disguise for the direction that we wanted last year. But our win streak and our end win total was a little misleading.
Yeah, I mean, I can also – it's so hard to say misleading because, I mean, we were trying to lose for large swaths of the season too, and then we weren't trying to win. And I think we could have won a large percentage of those games, but, you know, it's neither here nor there. Let's go on to the next question I had. What's your problem with advanced analytics? So, I mean, Matt threw out there about the net positive, and my whole point on that was just in general – it's really hard to judge the net positive on some of these players, and Zach LaVine specifically. He played a tremendous amount of minutes in for one season in Minnesota on a good team, and then, you know,
well, they weren't even really that good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's my point. I mean, so when you know the whole point in net positive, you know, the team is better with him off the court. Well, who knows? He had a large percentage. He's playing against starters. He was starting. So he's playing against better competition when he's off the court. I don't know how those games finish. I think that's such a misleading stat, number one, because you don't know how these combinations are. You're playing against the starters. That team that you're playing against is probably better than when you're off the court in a blowout when guys are, you know, leaving the court. And in net positive, last year he played 24 or 27 games. And, you know, in those he had limited minutes. Trying to do a lot in those minutes. He's always playing against better competition, playing against the starters. He started, I think, almost every one of those games. I don't think you can make those kind of that advanced analytics on the net positive. I don't like that stat, period. That said, what I have a problem with advanced analytics is the same guys who like to throw out advanced analytics were the same guys who complained about Paul Gasol. And every advanced analytic I saw regarding rim defender said that Gasol was an excellent defender, one of the best in the league, elite rim defender. But they'll never, when it comes to throwing out that, then they're complaining about Paul Gasol or about weight. You know, just look at the PER, which is an advanced analytic. He had an 18 PER, which is higher than Kirk Heinrich ever had in his career. I mean, they're complete hypocrites. They'll throw out the advanced analytics for some players, but they don't for others. So advanced analytics, yeah, I go by the eyeball test combined with some stats that mean a lot to me. You know, yeah, I think you can't go everything on advanced analytics, and just in general. You need to also look at your eyeball test, look at some stats that I still consider to be sacred and important, three-point percentage, free throw percentage. There's still some stats that you can use to judge if a player is good or not. I'm not going to rest everything on advanced analytics. What say you?
I tend to do both, like you said. I'll use my eye test first, and then if I have a concern or something that stands out to me, I'll go and I'll, you know, check to see what and if it matches up with what I thought. And I do agree from the sense, you know, Zach LaVine was a third option in Minnesota. It's not like he was the guy and he was hurting his team the whole time. could be a product of the team not using him enough or using him in the right spots. So those kind of things I do think are misleading. When you look at a skill set in general with your eye test, you can tell that Zach LaVine can get up his own shot whenever he wants, and he's fairly effective at doing so. He can also get to the rim, which he needs to prove he can do more. But a lot of those stats are based on opportunity and situation. So I can understand where you have a slight distaste towards people who just want to point at that all the time. That being said, stuff like box plus minus does stand out. I think Dwayne Wade was a negative 62 box plus minus overall on the year
Last year? No, not last year.
When he was with the Bulls. Okay. Season with the Bulls. He was a negative 62 plus minus on the year. So obviously that's a cumulative, but that's obviously not pretty. And your eye test would tell you that Dwayne Wade was not trying on defense and he was generally cherry picking. So, you know, those kind of things I think the eye test matches up to. As for Jabari Parker and Zach LaVine, I do have my concerns when it comes to the net positive analytics because they are going to be playing the wing together in a wing dominant league. But they have a new opportunity in a new system, and if they're utilized better, I think the sky could be the limit. They're also still kind of rookies. Both of them haven't played four full seasons in the NBA, and they're still 23 years old. So I don't think you can use that as the official stamp on what they're going to be for their career.
Let's go back to the questions. I don't understand your Parker at the three argument. 33% in his best year. With the question and a question that came from Tim, I don't want to mention his last name. My whole point, what I said on the show was I think taken a little bit out of context. My point was in Parker's best year, in most of the seasons he played in Milwaukee, he was playing about 25% of his time at the three. In his best year was the year in Milwaukee where he had his largest percentage of time. Was about a third at a time at the three. You know, I think bigger picture, Parker is not going to have any problems on the offensive end. The question is defensively against the better threes in the league. My bigger point is, who are the best threes in the league? And it's LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Jimmy Butler, Paul George, DeMar DeRozan, Kawhi Leonard. What? Five out of those six I just mentioned play in the West. 30 games against the West, 52 against the East. The best threes in this conference: Otto Porter, Robert Covington. Who are the best threes in the East that you're going to worry about? Oh my God, how is Jabari Parker going to stop him on a night tonight? And honestly, if a team is willing to throw out their offense to take advantage of that matchup, run with it. I used to remember say that with Ben Gordon all the time. There weren't a ton a great twos at the time in the East. If you want to affect your offense and change it and have Ben Gordon to take advantage of Ben Gordon's defense, go right ahead with it. My big picture is there aren't enough great threes in the East for me to lose sleep on how is Jabari going to defend the three. And then when those happen and you have those matchups, well, it's up to Fred to make sure that he does his best not to get hurt by it.
I think it's more of the combination of Jabari and Zach on the wing that scares people. You don't have somebody that Jabari, can comfortably just push his man into and Zach out there with him that takes the pressure off him. You have two liabilities there. Lauri Markkanen is a good team defender. I wouldn't say he's the best solution for that. We don't know if Wendell Carter Jr. is going to be the starter or if he's going to be coming off the bench. So he might not be with that unit.
Yeah, but you still got Lopez, who's rock solid defensively. Like, I think you would say the best three defenders on the Bulls, probably in order, Chris Dunn, Robin Lopez, and Wendell Carter Jr. I think Wendell Carter Jr. has first-team All-NBA defensive potential, but he's not going to win it in his first year. He's an excellent defender. That's a fact. The problem is with the stupid NBA officiating, they never give benefits to rookies the benefit of doubt. He's going to always be in foul trouble. He's not going to be a first-team All-NBA defender in his first year.
It's not like Hoiberg speaks up very much. We saw that with Dunn last year, and that drove me nuts.
Absolutely. Agree 100% on that. But so, I agree I made this point on the last show, and I'll stand by it. I don't think the Bulls are. It's clear. I'm not, you know, a moron. They're not going to be a defensive juggernaut. The good news is their best defenders are at the one and the five. And I think if you have to have good defense, it's got to be at those two positions. Ideally, in an ideal world, if you had to say, where's your best defender? I would say first it would be at the center position, but I think your second position could be, would it either be four or the one at the point of attack. And they sure as heck have that in Dunn and, you know, Lopez and Wendell Carter Jr. You know, what say you?
Well, I will add, from a team defense standpoint, I do think the Bulls could surpass expectations. They have a lot of damn size. You know, our point guard's nearly 6'5". He is our best defender on the floor, which makes him versatile just about 1 through 3. Zach, when he's engaged, obviously has the physical tools to be a good defender, as long as he's not taking a nap and conserving energy for offense. He has the ability to be a good team defender. Bari, once again, comes down to effort. Obviously, that's what defense is. As for Larry, I think he gets a little too much flack on this end. When you watch the games when he plays with Finland, you can tell how important he is to their team defense. Not singularly. He's not, you know, the most elite rim protector in the world. But as a team defender, he is very valuable to their team when he's off the floor. You can see the dysfunction. And like you said, then we have Robin Lopez and Wendell Carter Jr. So I do think from a team standpoint, we could surprise some people, but there's just obviously the major concerns, which all could go away. They're all young, and you got to learn how to win as a team, and you got to learn how to close games and play defense.
That's a great point, though, you brought up. Size-wise, I mean, they're going to be so long and so big on the perimeter. I mean, just getting your hands up will do a lot of good. I mean, when Jabari Parker is 6'9", playing the three, I mean, that's a big guy. So, you know, who knows? Another point in the same email that I didn't get to is about Bobby Portis, and I had made the point that you give all of the 4 minutes at the four to Parker kind of leading the second unit, and the guy in the email kind of countered and said, what about Portis? And to me, Bobby Portis is a five. He's a modern-day five. He's not good enough athletically to play major minutes at the four. I think he's a five. Play him at the five. He shoots the ball extremely well. I don't think there's one great five in the East, really, at the center position, obviously. Joel Embiid, he can't guard him at all. You know, so maybe.
Well, no, last year, Bobby had a pretty big game against the Sixers with Embiid because he was just running him up and down the floor.
That's a great point. Yeah. So, but I mean, defensively, though, if they throw Embiid in the post, you know, I think Bobby might have some problems, but. Let's just play him at center. He'll be our backup center along Wendell Carter Jr. and Lopez, and we'll figure it out. Between those five guys, we'll get him well enough minutes. But I think in the long run, Bobby's the guy we probably would foresee us trading and parting ways with.
Well, and I think that might have been the point that the listener was trying to get at, is that signing Jabari Parker and drafting Wendell Carter Jr., you've kind of got a logjam there. And Bobby Portis is probably going to want a decent amount of money. And if Jabari Parker can prove that he's healthy and effective at a 3-4 forward spot, then you likely just pick up his option instead of paying Bobby Portis long-term anyway. So Bobby does become the odd man out, and that's probably what the concern is, you know, you got this young player who has never had any injury concerns, showed a lot of promise last year, has aspirations to be the sixth man of the year, and now you're either kicking him or Wendell Carter Jr. to the curb unless you trade Robin Lopez early in the season to open up that kind of room.
Yeah. Good points. Back to the emails. Regarding the tanking, there was a long question from Matt P. I'm not going to – again, unless you tell me to read the last name read your last name, I'm not going to mention. But Matt said basically, I don't understand your point on tanking. How is it possible that there'll be less teams tanking this year? I don't understand why he would say less, because my whole point was, Matt was making the point, Matt Peck on the last Lockdown Bulls show, is that there's going to be less teams tanking this year. And I countered with, how do you know that? I don't know if that's entirely true. I have no idea. And I brought up the point of Memphis. Memphis wasn't tanking to start the season last year. They lost their best player, and then they decided to tank. It was probably the right move, and absolutely was the right move. They weren't going to win a title last year, and then they ended up getting a great player this year in the draft, I feel, in Jaren Jackson. So I think it was a great move on their part. How do we know who's going to tank or not? Let's say, hypothetically, Milwaukee loses Giannis in the second week of the year for the year. I'm not wishing that on anybody. I don't want to see anybody get hurt, but let's throw out that hypothetical. Do you really think Milwaukee's going to be a great team? Do you think they're? I can't see them getting into the playoffs without Giannis. Why wouldn't they try to tank? We don't know who's going to tank, and I think that the new rules maybe even could potentially backfire, and you could see teams that are 9, 10, 11, 12 actually try to lose more games in order to improve their likelihood of getting a top pick. You know, we don't know. What say you?
I say you have a good point at the end where it could backfire in a sense where the odds are increased throughout. So while being the worst used to be the best thing for you, now you don't even have to be the worst. You just have to be bad. So that could increase teams to do that. But I do think when you look at teams like Phoenix, they added Trevor Ariza. Several of the teams that were bad added veteran presences that, you know, at least give the appearance of trying to win. Even the Hawks added Vince Carter, and I'm sure he'll only play 10-15 minutes. But, you know, having that veteran knowledge there does help, having that motivation. So I get the point. I do think there will be less teams tanking, though. I think at least to start, I don't think there's going to be many teams coming out the gate like, we want to lose. I think every team's going to give it their all the first half. And then situationally at the trade deadline, like usual, there will be buyers and sellers.
Great. Fred, what were you talking about in terms of criminal abuse by Tibbs with Kyle Korver? And he also had a longer question regarding the Rose issue that Matt cut off. He didn't want to talk about Tibbs and the Rose issue and the minutes issue. So what I was talking about in terms of Tibbs' criminal abuse of use of Korver. Korver was unique in that he wasn't played enough by Tom Thibodeau. He played his first year with the Bulls. He was in the prime of his career, and he averaged 20 minutes per game. He hardly played in the playoffs. And his next year, he played only 22 minutes per game and hardly played in the playoffs. That's what how Tibbs utilized a guy who subsequently made an all-star team for Atlanta at the shooting guard position. That's all I ever had. All I had to endure for all those years, we need to find a shooting guard. We need to find a shooting guard. We had a shooting guard. He wasn't used by our idiot coach.
Got one of the best three-point shooters in the history of the NBA, and he didn't use him enough, but you're still looking for a shooter.
Yeah, but why? Yeah, exactly why. Because Tibbs didn't like his defense. Well, yeah, every player is not going to be perfect on both sides of the court. Korver was an offensive-minded player who hit the three better than anyone in arguably the history of the NBA. He did wonders for Rose when he was out on the court. He extended the floor, basically made it 4-on-4. But, you know, our idiot coach wanted to have Keith Bogans in his fake toughness. And, you know, just so stupid, it's beyond belief. Another point I'll make about Korver. So, yeah, he did not use him correctly. Another point about Korver was how he did not use him correctly was Korver shot 49%. This is all top of my head, so I don't know for sure, but you guys can look it up. 49% from three for Utah the year before he arrived in Chicago. Then he shot, I think, 41, right around there. And then when he leaves Chicago, he goes back up to 47 or 48, 49, somewhere around there. That is a massive, massive difference in hitting the three. You know, 6 percentage points is huge. So for him to go from 44.9 to 44.1 is a massive drop-off. Well, why did that drop-off happen? It happened because the idiot coach decided to not insert Korver into a game until right around the middle of Q2. Which is beyond dumb for anyone who knows how to shoot. You finish your last shot in warm-ups, and then you're sitting for almost a full quarter and a half when in real time, I don't know, what's that, 30 minutes? Anybody who's played basketball knows that you're not going to be hot when you come into a game. So that's why he took a little bit of a dip in Chicago. Tibbs did not use Kyle Korver correctly, and I will stand by that point, and my point is valid there. What say you?
No, I'd have to agree on your point there, especially as we pointed out, just the constant message of, we need more shooting, we need more shooting, we got to spread the floor for Derek. Well, you have this guy right here who's going to go down as one of the best three-point shooters in NBA history, and you didn't use him properly. Yeah, so, no, I fully agree with you on that aspect.
And to follow up the point I made on Lockdown Bulls, 2011, the Bulls, and 2012 team, 2012 team was significantly better. Like, Matt made this point, well, how do you know the Heat were, the Bulls couldn't have beat the Heat in 2012? The Heat were a much better team in 2012. The Bulls were a better team. I know I brought up Rip Hamilton. He had a nice laugh about that. I don't care. Rip Hamilton was better than Keith Bogans. I could find, you know, a pile of a diaper better than Keith Bogans. I mean, you could start – give me a break. The 2012 Bulls also had Jimmy Butler as their third, you know, as a guy on that team, on that squad. He didn't improve the team? Are you kidding me? You know, yeah. So, yeah, the Heat might have been a little bit better. The Bulls were definitely better in 2012. And then the emailer wanted me to expound on what I was about to tell him, and he didn't want to listen to it. But I'll get into it now, and then I'd like your opinion on it. The strike shortened 2011-2012 team, the Bulls, that team. First of all, the season was strike shortened, period. End of story. So which means is there were – Bulls had a lot of back-to-backs, not a lot of rest between games, and yet our idiot coach decided to, you know, play Dang into the ground, lead the league in minutes. And also, his use of Rose that year I thought was an abomination. What do you mean, Fred? Here's a couple examples. On January 10th of 2012, Rose plays 41 minutes. The next day, he's wearing a walking boot and sitting out a 14-point win over the Wizards on the 11th of January. The 13th and 14th, he plays 39 minutes. This is after wearing a walking boot. Having a walking boot, 2 days later, he plays 39 and 41 minutes. Are you serious? Like, are you kidding me? After that game on the 14th, he sits out the next four games because his toe flared up. After he comes back from that, here's his minutes in the next games. 36, 38, 37, 44, 40, 31, 39, 35. This is after he's had a toe injury. Then he sits out the next five straight games with back issue. And you don't think this is related at all? There's nothing here? Like, all these idiots out there doesn't think this has nothing to do with it. And Rose was joking around, I feel like an old man. So he comes back after missing, you know, February 10th through the 18th, five straight games. He comes back, and in his very next game, he's playing 40 minutes against the stinking Hornets. I mean, how stupid, when you go back and you look at these games that Rose missed and the minutes that he's playing in between injuries, it's beyond belief. It's beyond belief. I know in 2018, if this happened in 2018, somebody would get fired over it. But it was 2012. You know, we really hadn't seen Kerr with the resting, and I didn't even think Popovich at that point hadn't really gone over on it. Back to the minutes, March 14th to April 5th, Rose sits 12 games with a groin issue. And then 16th to the 19th, as the season winds down, he's out with a fifth different injury to his right foot. First game of playoffs, he tears his ACL. Now, I know a lot of you Tib defenders are out there, stupidly nodding, you know, saying it had nothing to do with it. Had every freaking thing to do with it. This coach played this guy through five separate injuries, insane minutes, didn't let him sit, didn't let him get better. Even Taj Gibson admitted that Tibbs would encourage guys to play hurt. He was throwing that crap in that block room. I know he was to Rose here. And he tears his ACL. He doesn't get any to blame for it. He had everything to do with that ACL tear. So I wanted to get into that minute injury, that minutes issue. But, he didn't want to talk about it. That's fine. It's his prerogative. This is my show. I just talked about it. What say you?
I say anybody who's still denying the fact that Thibs overplays his starters is kind of crazy. You had players last year on the bench in Minnesota coming out, or even the starters going, we don't know what's going on. We don't know why he's not playing the bench. They had freaking Jamal Crawford who left because he wasn't used properly and he didn't feel, you know, welcome because he didn't get played nearly enough. So I think Thibs is on his last limb here in Minnesota, especially with all the stuff going on.
Yeah.
Who knows if Tom's even going to be in the league as a head coach past next season, depending on what the Wolves do. I think it's impossible to deny that Thibs at least had a good amount to do with the Bulls' decline. There are three players on the team that were the pillars of the team, kind of all deteriorated in the matter of a short span of years.
Yeah, Rose Noah can barely play now. And, I mean, the only reason Rose is still playing is because he missed almost two full seasons, right? He avoided a lot of that nonsense. Tibbs can only see the game in front of his fat face. That's it. Period. He refused to sit these guys and rest them, and that led us year after year to disappointing playoffs, year after year, because we were way too tired or worn down. If you guys don't believe that, and you're still making arguments for this moron, just pound sand. It's a fact. I just threw these stats out there about what happened to Rose that year. It's inexcusable what happened. I mean, it's just unbelievable people make excuses for this idiot. And every year I have to put up with this nonsense. So, fine. If you're going to make excuses for him, let's go see how Minnesota does this year with their weak-ass defense. I still get emails and questions about that. People upset because I had the temerity to insult the great Coach Rain Man. Pound sand. Guy cost his titles because of his stupid playing habits. Minutes that he's divvied out. All right, where was I? What's the last question here? I think that's it. Before we wrap things up, brother, I really appreciate your time. Gosh, we're over. Where are we at? 40 minutes already. There were a couple more questions here about the polls. The ESPN poll that Matt was referring to, one emailer, noted that was done in 2017, right after the trade of Jimmy Butler for Lauri Markkanen, and he wonders how that would be now. I don't care how it is now. I went and looked at that poll. They still had Orlando ahead of the Bulls. Again, I don't understand how anyone could possibly have Orlando's front office ranked ahead of the Bulls, regardless of how bad you think Gar Forman and John Paxson are. There's no objective measure that you could possibly come to that would say Orlando's got a better front office than us. So any poll that I see that has Orlando ranked as a better front office, I immediately take it and throw it right in the trash. I don't care if it's done by peers. There's no way you can come to that conclusion until they have a better record than us, you know, maybe once in the past decade. So, anyhow, what say you?
Oh, no, I say that's pretty ridiculous. I think Gar Packs get a little too much criticism. Granted, they're under a bigger microscope than a lot of other teams, but as you guys went through on Lockdown Bulls, Bulls draft well. If anything, the Bulls' biggest mistakes have been their coaching decisions in the Gar Packs era. They've had the biggest problem with coaches. Obviously, there's trades that we wish would have gone a little better. But when it comes to talent evaluation and drafting, I don't know that there's many better front offices in the league than the Bulls. And that is my one sticking point of, you know, when all the Fire Gar Packs stuff is going on. And initially, I was kind of hurt. And I was feeling that side of it until I started doing a little more research. And you look at their draft picks compared to everybody else. I don't know how you can try to, you know, take away from what this front office has done. Our last contending team was all drafted. Like, I don't, you know, so in that regard, no, I don't know how they could rank so low on a list when their draft record is as spotless as it is.
Yeah, when it comes to drafting, I mean, only OKC, I think, has a real argument, and Golden State, probably too. No doubt Golden State. But OKC, you know, drafted, obviously.
Three MVPs.
Yeah, that's pretty good. Westbrook. But then again, those were all top five picks. You know, the Bulls have had gems, really. I mean.
Well, no, with what they've been given, the Bulls have done miraculous things. As you pointed out, the Jimmy Butler pick, one of the best picks. Probably at least the last 10 years. So to be able to hit in the back end, but also hit in the front end when you have a top 10 pick, that speaks volumes. And they rarely, outside of the Snells and the McDermotts, who aren't necessarily misses, they're still in the league. Did they reach the potential that was seen for them when they were drafted? No. But Tony Snell's still making $10 million a year. Doug McDermott's making $7 million a year. So, yeah, they're busts in the sense that, you know, they didn't reach their potential while they were in Chicago, but they're still in the league. They weren't.
It's not Jamil Okafor. It's not Okafor-ish where, you know, the guy's barely hanging on to a job outside of his first pro team. You know what I mean? And you're taking that ahead of Porzingis.
And we could have taken Beasley, who was in that exact situation over Rose. So,
amen. We definitely see the eye to eye on that, and I'm fine with, you know, hey, after this rebuild, if we don't hit it, let's try someone. I'll be fine going with somebody else if that's what you guys want to do. They've had a long enough run, no doubt on that. I just disagree with the assessment they've been a disaster, because it's not anywhere near true, and I tried to make that point on Lockdown Bulls. So thanks, everyone, for listening to the latest Chicago Bullseye. You can reach me at CBEFred, at CBEFred, or send me on Twitter, or send me an email at ChicagoBullseye@gmail.com. Keith, where can everybody find you?
At BullScripted on Twitter and at BullScripted.com.
Sounds good, my friend. Great talking again. Great getting caught up. And until next time, baby, Bulls and basketball. Looking forward to our as we're moving closer to season, to having more of these discussions.
Hey, sounds good, boss.
Have a good one.
Talk to you soon.
Talk to you later, brother. Bye-bye.